I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Time. Solitary confinement has gone in and out of favor over the years in the United States. When Eastern State Penitentiary opened in Philadelphia in 1829, its single cells and prisoner isolation were seen as reform, giving inmates the chance to reflect on their crimes and the opportunity to rehabilitate themselves. 60 years later, a U.S. Supreme Court justice criticized the treatment of prisoners at Eastern State, which closed in the 20th century. Today, the facility is a popular tourist attraction. Meanwhile, solitary confinement has been staging a comeback. Proponents contend it can make a prison a safer place, while critics counter it's a form of cruel and unusual punishment. Coming up, we'll explore the current controversies about solitary confinement, but first, a short history lesson. Sean Kelly joins us, Vice President and Director of Programming and Public Relations at Eastern State Penitentiary. And Sean Kelly, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for including us.
You're very welcome. Going back to the beginning of the 19th century, what was the thinking, the philosophy that went into the creation of Eastern State?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that it was a reform effort. I mean, people don't think about this, but you know, virtually all prisons in the world in the 1800s, the early 1800s, were modeled after either Eastern State Penitentiary or after Sing Sing. It was the New York model versus the Pennsylvania model, and they both believed that people had to be isolated from one another in order to contain the bad influences of a corrupt society. Eastern State was the world's first true penitentiary. It's a building designed to inspire penitence, inspire regret. And so they believed that people had to be cut off from other people, and it was, and at least in the attitude, it was definitely a step forward from other prisons of the day, which were, you know, violent and disease-ridden. But the punishment that they came upon was true solitary confinement for years at a time, and it was copied all over the world. There were hundreds of copies of Eastern State and of Sing Sing all over the world.
I've been to Eastern State as a tourist, as a visitor, and describe the cells there for our listeners, Sean.
Well, the outside of the prison looks like a castle, and when people get to the inside, I think they're often very surprised to find the inside is all arches and sunlight. If the outside says physical punishment or dungeon, the inside of the building looks like a church. It's got hundreds and hundreds, or actually thousands of skylights, so it's all lit with sunlight. It's got arched cells that look like little monks' cells, and it was meant to be a place of enforced spiritual reflection. They wanted people to look into their hearts and to become penitent, and they built this sort of church-like space on the inside, thinking that mission would run through every aspect of life here inside these walls.
And what would a prisoner do all day at Eastern State?
Not much. They lived in what they hoped was total silence, even to the point where the guards covered their shoes with socks. They worked in their cells. The original overseers were hired for their skills in teaching different trades, things like shoemaking. And the inmates lived 23 hours a day inside of their own little cell. Most of them are about 8 by 12 feet. They have a skylight, so there's sunlight coming in, but no windows facing out, just the sky above. And then for 2 half-hour breaks a day, they'd go outside into their own personal exercise yard that's about the same size as the cell itself, about 8 by 12. They'd be outside alone as well. In theory, they would never see anyone aside from the guards during a typical sentence of 2 or 3 years here.
And I also read from some of the material from Eastern State that when they left the cell, not to go outside to get fresh air, but when they actually left the cell, they were hooded, so they wouldn't see other people, and other people, I guess, wouldn't see them.
That's right. Yeah, as soon as they arrived in the building, they had their heads covered with a hood with no eye holes. So I always think about this when I see terrorism suspects transported with their heads hooded. That's how inmates here were moved around in the building. Just as you say, to maintain their anonymity and also to maintain the security of the prison, there's only one door. Like most prisons, Eastern State has only one door. And they didn't want the inmates to know where it was or how the prison was laid out. But you can imagine, maybe you can't, I struggle to imagine this myself actually, being led blind, you know, through the corridors of this echoey but almost silent building, being placed into a white room with just a skylight above, having that hood removed, and really having no idea what the world was like around you, whether you had neighbors on the left or the right, or where in the world you were. And that was supposed to be the entire world that you would experience during your stay. And they knew this was going to be a difficult punishment for the inmates. They were very clear about that. They knew this was going to be harsh. But they believed that it was the only solution to bring out the best character in these inmates.
And did it work, or at least work for some inmates?
It's a very safe bet that it did not. Their understanding of mental and psychiatric health was so primitive, and they had so few ways of even tracking what happened to inmates when they left, that it's really hard to know what was happening. But I'll be curious to hear from some of your other guests if there's any evidence that prolonged isolation improves the character of the inmate. They believed this. They absolutely believed this, and they thought that today we'd be living in a world free of crime because of this massive building. And it's hard to exaggerate just how big and expensive and ambitious this building was. It was 10.5 acres, which for the 1820s, sometimes I tell school kids, is like the Death Star up here, this enormous, enormous building. Certainly the most expensive prison ever built, the most ambitious prison ever built, with running water and central heat before the White House had either of those things, all with the belief that people could be rehabilitated through isolation. And that system completely failed. I mean, what the actual effect was on the human beings is something that is very hard to get at because of their record keeping. But just for the logistics and for the lack of proof and for the growing criticism anecdotally that it was driving people insane, the entire system collapsed in 1913, and the prison finished out its history as a congregate prison where the inmates could speak and eat together and work together and so forth.
Well, Charles Dickens famously visited Eastern State Penitentiary. This was, I guess, shortly after it opened.
That's right, 1842.
And here's some of what he wrote, obviously critical of Eastern State. He said, "I hold this slow and daily tampering with the mysteries of the brain to be immeasurably worse than any torture of the body, and because its ghastly signs and tokens are not so palatable to the eye." Really talking about what he imagined the mental state of prisoners who were in isolation.
That's right. I mean, Dickens wrote a book about the United States and dedicated a chapter to Eastern State Penitentiary. So it shows you the influence it was having across the world. And he was very, very critical of the system of solitary confinement here. He had a lifelong fascination with prisons and was deeply concerned about the system of isolation coming out of Philadelphia. And that document that you just read, I'm glad you read that quote. We read that sometimes on our tours.
Yeah.
It's 150 years old, or close to it. And even before Dickens, the Marquis de Lafayette, who had been so crucial in helping Washington win the War of Independence, came back to celebrate 50 years of American independence in 1826. They brought him up the hill, and this was before Eastern State was even complete. And they said, "Hey, look at this amazing prison, the largest, most ambitious prison ever built, and we're going to base the entire system on solitary confinement." And we have a letter, actually it's in the Rosenbach here in Philadelphia, the Rosenbach Museum.
Sure.
We have a letter from Lafayette back to the people in Philadelphia saying, "You'll remember that I took the liberty of expressing my deep concern about your system of solitary confinement." And, Lafayette had served time in solitary confinement himself during the French Revolution when he was in Austria. And he spoke from personal experience that he was very critical and wanted to put it in writing and make sure that they hadn't missed that point. Mm-hmm. That he expressed concern. These documents are almost a century and a half old. People really concerned that this was not the way that you would bring out the best in human nature.
On the other hand, we have Alexis de Tocqueville with Gustave de Beaumont visited Eastern State Penitentiary 1831, and let me quote what they said. "Can there be a combination more powerful for reformation than that of a prison which hands over the prisoner to all trials of solitude, leads him through reflection to remorse, through religion to hope, makes him industrious by the burden of idleness?"
Yeah, I'm going to make you a tour guide, Marty. You're really great at
Well, it's a fascinating place to visit, but that's for a whole other discussion. But go ahead, Sean.
But I think it's so interesting to get those two perspectives. We often look at those two documents and those two takes on this building. I guess one of the things I would say is that, not to play favorites, but Tocqueville was here so much earlier than Dickens was, and he really saw the building when it first opened, and there was a lot of enthusiasm around that system. And if you're going to be critical of the early reformers who built Eastern State, I mean, the people who built this building had enormous optimism and were willing to invest great resources in trying to improve the most disenfranchised members of society. So, you know, on the one hand, they were really trying their hardest to improve the lives of criminals, convicts, and give them a shot at a new life. they had really no idea what effect prolonged isolation was going to have. They really just said, I mean, when Tocqueville writes that, that's him having met a handful of inmates and saying, this looks good to me. But there was just no sense of what, no study, no scientific study about what prolonged isolation, what effects that would have on the human spirit. But other people looked at that, people like Dickens, who also was only speaking from instinct, and said, this just can't be a good idea. Or there are people like the Marquis de Lafayette, who said, I've been through this. I'm telling you that this is not the way to bring out the best in people's hearts. Now, later in that chapter, Dickens talks about meeting some of the overseers, and they tell him what it's like to watch the inmates leave solitary confinement. And Dickens says, or the overseers tell him, and even given, you know, the possibility that Dickens is exaggerating a little bit, it's a really disturbing image that he paints of the inmates sitting down and standing up 20 times in a minute, and their hands shaking so hard they can't sign their names, and walking out the front of the building, staggering like they're drunk. This is 150 years ago that there were already these deep concerns about the effects of solitary confinement.
And Sean, about a minute and a half before we have to say goodbye, I want to quote somebody else, and this is from 1890, U.S. Supreme Court Justice Samuel Freedman Miller, talking about Eastern State, finds a considerable number of the prisoners fell after even a short confinement into a semi-fatuous condition from which it was next to impossible to arouse them, and others became violently insane going on from there. Obviously, critical of solitary confinement, certainly at Eastern State Penitentiary.
Over time, over the 1800s, that opinion became very, very popular, very common. Eastern State was really the flagship of this type of a prison that was going to, you know, house inmates in solitary confinement. It was one of the first, and it was one of the last, that really argued that this was going to benefit the inmates. So, yes, by the late 1800s, you get many, many people being highly critical. You know, I was just reading an article, getting ready to talk to you this morning, pointing out that half of the inmates who commit suicide in prisons in the United States are serving time in solitary confinement. So the document you read from the Supreme Court in the 1890s is already showing the concern about what happens to the psyche, you know, over prolonged isolation. It's been a concern for going on 200 years now.
And Sean, we're almost out of time here, but as Director of Programming at Eastern State Penitentiary, have you changed your mind about solitary confinement, having spent so much time there and so much time thinking about the penitentiary?
I have.
You have?
I've mostly concluded that I don't have any idea what it's all about. You know, that I've been doing this. I've been in this job for 18 years, and I used to be much more confident that I understood what people go through when they're confined. And over time, I've just seeing the historical record of what people do under those circumstances, it just makes no sense to the just again and again you see examples of people doing things that make no sense when you look at them from the outside. And mostly I've concluded that I don't really understand what that's like, especially solitary confinement. I don't think anyone can really imagine it.
We have to say goodbye. I thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you for including us.
You're welcome. Sean Kelly, Vice President, Director of Programming and Public Relations at Eastern State Penitentiary. Coming up, we will talk about solitary confinement today. We'll be right back.
Is your child struggling in school? Supporting WHYY, Delaware Valley Friends, a Quaker College preparatory school in Paoli for students who learn differently. Delaware Valley Friends is committed to providing small classes, individual attention, state-of-the-art technology, and an accredited curriculum and faculty for grades 6 through 12. Open house on Wednesday, May 1st from 9 to 11 a.m. More information about Delaware Valley Friends at dvfs.org. Registration now open for summer reading and writing program.
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Have you made a pledge of support to WHYY yet? We're in the middle of the spring membership drive, and as soon as we reach our goal, we will end this campaign. We can only do it if you call 1-888-345-9499 or pledge online at WHYY.org. You're listening to Where Your Money Goes to support programs like Radio Times. We bring you regional, national, and international news and analysis, and we keep you informed about the important issues of the day. We also also introduce you to interesting people and ideas. We believe you're the kind of person who wants that kind of programming. So if you have never made a pledge or you have let your membership lapse, now is the time to take that step and become a listener supporter. You'll be happy you did. Here's that phone number again. It's 1-888-345-9499. Again, you can pledge online at WHYY.org. Whatever you can afford, take that next step, and we thank you in advance. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're talking about solitary confinement, past, present, and future. We just said goodbye to Sean Kelly, Director of Programming at Eastern State Penitentiary. Today in the U.S., about 25,000 prisoners are housed in solitary confinement. And in Pennsylvania, about 5% of the prison population is being held in solitary, known as restricted housing units. We have two more guests who have joined us for the rest of the hour today on Radio Times. Jules Lobel is a professor at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law, also president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, currently involved with the center's class action lawsuit on behalf of the prisoners at Pelican Bay Prison in California, arguing that solitary confinement practices are violations of the U.S. Constitution. And Jules Lobel, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here with you.
Also with us is Shirley Moore Smeal, Executive Deputy Secretary for the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections. And Shirley Moore Smeal, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you, Marty. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let me begin with you, if I could, because we want to focus on Pennsylvania. We want to focus on solitary confinement. How many prisoners in the state of Pennsylvania are, I guess, locked up 23 hours a day in a single cell?
At this time, we have about 2,500 inmates who fall into that category.
And how does one fall into that category?
They can be placed in a restricted housing unit based on administrative custody status, which is for their own protection or if they're under investigation. Also, the death penalty cases are on administrative custody. Or they can also be placed there through disciplinary procedures, through the hearing examiner, and that's based on rule infractions that are committed within the prison environment.
And what percentage of the overall population, prison population in Pennsylvania is that?
That's about 5% of the population.
And do you call it solitary confinement? Is that the language that the state uses?
We use restricted housing unit or specialized housing units for those inmates that are confined in their cell 23 hours a day or more. Solitary confinement is not really a term that's used within the system unless it's referring to different phases of the death penalty.
I want to get to all of that. Let me get you in on the conversation, Jules Lobel. You oppose solitary confinement. Tell us why.
Well, I think it crushes people's spirit, and it's an inherently antithetical to human dignity and to treating people with dignity. To keep somebody locked up 23 hours a day for years without much contact with other people, without any programs, without any educational programs, with very little recreation, I think is inhumane, and it was seen as inhumane in the 19th century. Somehow we've recreated this in the latter part of the 20th century, and it's an inhumane form of treatment which nobody should be subjected to.
Is that
certainly not for a long period of time?
Is that your definition of then cruel and unusual punishment?
Yes, we're arguing that keeping somebody in these kind of conditions, and in California, in Pelican Bay, people are being kept for decades. With no windows, no phone calls, very little contact with other people. They can call it whatever they want, either restricted housing units or special housing units. They have various euphemisms for it, but it's fundamentally solitary confinement in that you are taking away what is fundamental to human beings, which is social interaction.
Let me go. Finish your point. Go ahead.
And to take that basic need, human need, away from people is cruel and unusual treatment, I think.
Shirley Morris Smeal, you're using the word torture.
Yeah, I think it's a form of mental torture. It's a form of driving people crazy.
Let me give you a chance to respond to that, Shirley Morris Smeal. Do you see it as a form of cruel and unusual punishment?
I see it as, and the department views it as a way to maintain the safety of the staff and the inmates and the facility itself. Most of the people who are confined within the restricted housing units are there for a limited period of time. 30, 60, 90 days on average is what an offender spends. And even within our specialized units, they're designed to process an inmate through the phases of the program and to reenter general population within, you know, a 24-month period, and that's at the outset. All of the programs that we have, we do try and have activities for stimulation. We have required number of staff visits and interactions with those that are confined in a disciplinary status or even in administrative status. So we do have that interaction. Activities are provided. So it's limited. We really try and focus on the need for the individual and how we can best isolate them if necessary for safety and security, but also to provide them with programming to help them to reenter general population.
And what would that programming entail? And then I'll go back to you, Jules LaBelle.
The programming would entail an assessment of what the needs are. It may be involving thinking for a change programming or, you know, different psychological programs that's offered. We do, towards the end phases, bring them out in groups so that they have that interaction prior to going out to general population. But it's really designed based on the assessment of the individual and providing psychological services and, you know, access to law library and in-cell activities as well that they can participate in.
Just so I understand, I mean, if someone is in solitary or restricted housing unit, they could leave and go to the library?
They can leave and go to the law library that's contained within the same unit. We do have a rolling library where they can get books to read within their cell. They would not actually go to the general population library, but within the unit itself, the restricted housing unit, access to the law library is there, as well as to books from that they can request from the general population library that they can read in their cells.
Let me go back to you, Jules LaBelle, and just pick up on this safety issue. And Shirley Morris-Meal is saying it can be and is used for the safety of prisoners, for the safety of staff at a prison. What's your response to that?
Yeah, she paints a very rosy picture, but I think if you look at the concretely what's happening, and I know more about California, but I know some about Pennsylvania, and I'd give her one case, and I'm curious how she responds. I think there are other cases similar to this, and that's the case of Russell Schultz. Russell Schultz has been in solitary confinement or restricted housing for over 20 years. He hasn't had any disciplinary violations for a decade. Over 20 years ago, he tried to escape, and for that reason, I could see why there was a safety concern. But there hasn't been any serious concern for the last 10, 15 years, and he constantly gets reviewed, and they just simply say, well, what you did 20 years ago is keeping you in here. Now, they may be allowed out to the law library, but I'd like to know how often they're allowed out to the law library. They're not going out every day or even once every few days. I know in California they're allowed to the law library 1 or 2 hours a month. It's a rosy picture that's painted, but in fact the reality is something very different. And I'd like to see how Shirley comments to the case of Russell Schultz.
Go ahead, Shirley Morris.
Who's been kept in for not 30, 60, or 90 days, but over 20 years.
Go ahead.
And we do have the restricted release list, which is what you're referring to. And I don't mean to, you know, it's not painting a rosy picture. It's the reality of how we see the system and how the system is operating. There are those, and our process for restricted release was recently changed so that there is an annual review that's required at the facility level, and that annual review, both for continuation on the restricted release list as well as removal from that list, is now required to go up through a higher chain of custody for review. Many people are removed from the restricted release list. It's not a continuation, but it is based on individual circumstances of why they are placed there initially and what their progress and adjustment has been since they've been on it. You know, on the case that you're referring to, you know, an extended period of time, yes. Obviously, staff at the time believed that it was necessary. There has been movement on that particular case, and the plan of action is to do just that, develop a plan of action to assist him in getting to general population.
But is there any reason, I mean, you had mentioned people being put in solitary for 30, 60, or 90 days. What would be the reason that someone would be in solitary for 20 years?
And that would be based on their history within a department, what the initial reasons are for getting them onto a restricted release list. If you're on a restricted release list, that's a more restrictive list than being in the restricted housing unit or the process to get there.
Are you saying, though, Jules LaBelle, that it's hard to get out of solitary confinement in Pennsylvania or certainly for this individual prisoner?
It's very hard for people to get out of solitary confinement once you're on this restricted list. And in fact, as I said, the one case I know of very concretely, the man is now close to 70 years old. He's not a threat. He's no threat anymore, but they keep him there because it's sort of warehousing him there or for retaliatory reasons or who knows why. But the point is that he hasn't had any misconduct or violations for years, and yet he's still kept in this situation. And there are other people in Pennsylvania, not for quite as long a time, but who are kept in solitary confinement for many years. I know California better, and in California, in the one prison that I'm dealing with,
Pelican Bay,
there are over 500 people who've been there for over a decade. And the only really way out, and many of these people have no disciplinary violations whatsoever. They're there because of their association with some prison gang. And the only way out for them is to become an informant. I think it's obscene what's happening in California. And the system has to be changed. But there's very little evidence that California is seriously trying to change it.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. We are talking with Jules LaBelle, professor at the University of Pittsburgh Law School, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Shirley Moore Smeal is executive deputy secretary for the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections. And we are getting two very different opinions about solitary confinement, as it is called. And we do want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Shirley, you wanted to say something. Go ahead.
Yes, I did. Just in comment to, Jules had mentioned about California and the number that they have on solitary confinement. And in Pennsylvania right now, the restricted release list, we have 87 inmates that are on it. And those 87 inmates are, they're reviewed, as I had stated, they're reviewed annually. But the reasons why they get on that list are some of the conditions that they can be placed on the list for, include having a sexual assault history, escape history, that they represent an overall threat to the security of the facility, or a history of assaultiveness against staff. So we scrutinize those lists very carefully in the decision, and it's a balancing act whether someone goes on the restricted release list or when they come off of that list. And if the wrong decision is made, then the result is that people get hurt. So we take it very seriously, but we try and have the safeguards in place to make sure that they're interacting with people and that their needs are being addressed as well, and doing so in a manner that provides safety for the staff that work at the facility as well as the other inmates at the facility.
Jules LaBelle, let me go back to you. So if not solitary confinement, how does a prison deal with prisoners who are a threat to other prisoners and potentially a threat to staff as well?
Well, first of all, I think that solitary is way overused both in California and in Pennsylvania, particularly the long-term aspect of it. I think there are ways that you can encourage people to behave properly and get them out of solitary. And what has happened in Pennsylvania and in other states is that they've just been warehoused there. But in terms of what the alternative is, there are, and I brought this case in Ohio where they had put 500 people into the Supermax prison, which is their solitary. And after the judge looked at it and said, you need to really review people, because they had the same view. Well, we were reviewing people, but they were basically simply being kept in solitary, whatever the reviews were. It went down from 500 to 50. And that still may be 50 people too much, but at least it was a reduction in 90%. Mm. So I think the first point is there are way, way too many people being kept in solitary. Secondly, the conditions in solitary in Pennsylvania and in California and in other states are horrendous. It may be the case that you have to isolate some people from the general population, but there is no reason to give them virtually no meaningful recreation. They exercise in these little what they call dog runs, and just the name of it should suggest the inhumanity of it. Namely, there are small little cells in California. They had nothing in it. In Ohio, it was a cell inside the building with vents, which they called outdoor recreation because there was outdoor air coming in. They could create conditions which were humane, where people could communicate with other people but not be put in the general population. There may be some small group of people who have to be isolated from the general population, mm-hmm. but what is being done in these prisons is repressive, and it not only isolates people but it crushes them.
Shirley, going back to you and even looking at Pennsylvania, those people in these particular units, can they talk? They may not be able to see other prisoners, but can they talk to them? Are there ways that they can converse? And Jules LaBelle talks about the terrible conditions inside these cells. Do you agree?
No, I don't agree. The housing units and the restricted housing units where the offenders are kept are, you know, they meet the requirements for the American Correctional Association. Conversations can take place. You know, again, the interaction with staff, we have unit managers, counselors, psychologists, chaplains that make rounds. We have the officers on the housing units that make rounds, so the opportunity for interaction is there. You know, the conditions are what they are, but...
What are they?
I mean, as far as the individual exercise units or what Jules had referred to as the dog runs, you know, that is a cell that's or an area that's provided outside for them to exercise individually. So it is provided, but we believe that the conditions that are there in the restricted housing units are humane. We don't see that they're inhumane. And again, our goal is to restrict those that need to be restricted. And for those who need a temporary removal from population, or even a more sustained period of removal from population, to provide them with programs. The Special Management Unit program is a program specifically designed to work them from disciplinary custody time back in the general population. The same way with our Secure Special Needs Unit, which focuses on the mentally ill. You know, having 5% of the population in a restricted setting, you know, we would certainly agree that that is not ideal, that's mm-hmm. too much, that we need to reduce that number, and we are actively working to reduce that number.
Well, we have to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are getting two very different opinions about the solitary confinement. Shirley Moore Smeal, Executive Deputy Secretary for the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections, Jules LaBelle, Professor at the University of Pittsburgh Law School, and President of the Center for Constitutional Rights, 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
WHYY is a media sponsor for the Philadelphia Speaker Series, presented by Widener University, offering its 2013-14 season of diverse ideas, world perspectives, and thought-provoking conversation. 7 engaging evenings at the Kimmel Center, with a stellar lineup of speakers, including former Greek Prime Minister George Papandreou, author Bill Bryson, Ambassador John Huntsman, and historian Doris Kearns Goodwin. Information at philadelphiaspeakerseries.org.
I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We run this news service at WHYY on the Honor System. If you listen to any of the programs we present, then we thank you for becoming a supporter by making a pledge of support. You know the value of what you hear. That's why you listen. Now take that next step and pay for the service you use. You wouldn't eat a meal and not pay for it when you're finished, so don't be a listener who's not a supporter. Make a pledge right now at 1-888-345-9499, or you can pledge online at whyy.org. What can you afford? $60, $100, $250? You decide, and again, make that call at 1-888-345-9499. We do these membership campaigns just three times a year, about 99% of the rest of the broadcast time. It's the programs you enjoy. Radio Times, Fresh Air, Here and Now, Talk of the Nation, All Things Considered, Morning Edition, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Make a pledge, 1-888-345-9499. Thanks. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and we're exploring some of the controversies surrounding solitary confinement, isolation within the prison system. And again, Jules LaBelle, Shirley Moore-Smeal, our guests, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Shirley, I want to read just a quote from an article that was in the New Yorker just a couple of years ago by a surgeon, Atul Gawande. He writes about public health issues. And one of the things that he said about solitary confinement is this. He says, one of the paradoxes of solitary confinement is that as starved as people become for companionship, the experience typically leaves them unfit for social interaction. The idea that someone might be isolated for their good or for the good of the rest of the population, but it's counterproductive because it doesn't really help them deal with their social problems. Do you agree with that?
I think the social interaction and whether or not it's beneficial, I think that that's something that, you know, research has talked about. And in the last guest that you had on had made mention of that as well. I believe that it's our responsibility to try and maintain the stimulation to those that are in and balance it out with the security needs of the mm-hmm. facility as well.
But the idea, I mean, it seems sounds like you're also saying is that it would be a good thing to reduce the number of people in Pennsylvania who are currently in solitary confinement.
Yes, it would be. It would be. And with the secure special needs unit that we have that's mainly designed for the mental health, who also have behavioral issues along with that, you know, that system is being restructured so that we can better identify those that do have a mental health issue and get them the treatment for the mental health rather than having them confined mm-hmm. within a restricted housing unit setting. We also are just restructuring and adding another unit at our diagnostic center, which is a special assessment unit, again, to try and diagnose and determine as early in the process as we can what the needs of the offender are so that we can address them more efficiently and more effectively to even prevent them from being introduced to the restricted housing unit.
Just a little bit, let me go back to you. And you mentioned Pelican Bay. That's a supermax prison. You're involved in a lawsuit there. Supermax prisons have been built in, oh, I guess, over the last 30 years or so. What do you think explains the renewed interest in solitary confinement? We began the show today talking about the history of solitary confinement, a penitentiary here in Philadelphia that was based on that principle that was closed because it was seen as harsh and ineffective. Why do you think solitary confinement has staged a bit of a comeback?
Yeah, by the way, Charles Dickens visited that, and he said that mental torture is the worst form of cruel punishment. But I think it was expanded as solitary has made a comeback, so to speak, as part of the mass incarceration movement of the 1970s and 80s. And that this is all a method, I think, that solitary fits into this, of repressive control. Instead of using the prison experience as a way to rehabilitate prisoners, as a way of really trying to get prisoners to be able to go back into productive lives, what we're doing is, and solitary is the worst form of this, is warehousing them, where we're making them worse. And to have somebody, as many of these people do, go from solitary onto the street is a danger not to the prison population, but to the society in general. And that's why I think there has to be more educational programs, more recreational programs, more programming for these people in general. When Shirley says they get social contact, first of all, they have no contact visits whatsoever with family and friends. And to deny people any physical contact, even with visitors, I don't see the justification for that. And I, again, it's an aspect of the inhumanity of this. But to have some prison guard walk by and say, "How you doing?" That's not social interaction. In Pelican Bay, there are no windows or bars, so you can't really see anybody. And it's if one can imagine oneself in a situation like that, if the listener can, I don't know how long they can imagine that they would be able to keep their sanity.
Let me go back to you, Shirley, and ask about contact visits with family. Is that allowed for people in Pennsylvania who are in solitary?
For those that are on administrative custody and they request from the program review committee and are granted a contact visit, then yes, that is something that can happen with approval. In general, the visits for disciplinary custody or disciplinary custody is a non-contact visit. But the, you know, the just on the comment about the cells and the lighting, you know, there are windows, there is light. You know, that's available in our system.
I'm looking at a press release that came out in March. The Disability Rights Network of Pennsylvania has filed a federal lawsuit today challenging the unconstitutional treatment of prisoners with serious mental illness in solitary confinement known as restricted housing units in state correctional institutions. And Pennsylvania is part of this lawsuit. What's your response to that?
And my response is I think that there's always room for improvement. You know, I noted that we are in the process and have restructured our mental health department, our psychology department, specifically focusing on those individuals that are in the restricted housing unit that have a mental health issue. You know, our goal is to better identify them, to divert them from the restricted housing unit, and treat them for the mental illness that they have.
Mm-hmm. Let me go back. Go ahead, Jules LaBelle. Go ahead.
One of the key problems of solitary is that they have used it as a way to store essentially mentally ill people because many of the people who present disruptive problems in prison are disruptive because they're mentally ill, and they just put them in solitary and warehouse them there, and I think that's a problem in Pennsylvania and in many, many other states. Certainly nobody who's mentally ill should be placed in solitary.
For all the reasons that you just stated. Do you agree with that, Shirley?
I believe that, you know, again, I think that there is a balancing act between appropriately identifying who needs to be placed in those areas. And with the mentally ill, you know, again, I certainly agree, and that's why we're taking steps to better be able to address their needs, to identify them earlier in the process of who has a mental illness, who needs the treatment, you know, how often do the psychiatric visits need to occur, and just mental health programs in general. That's being restructured. We've expanded the number of the secure special needs units that we have for that purpose, to make sure that we're not confining someone who has a mental health illness into the special management unit with those who have behavioral problems and are separated out from the mental health problems. So, you know, we certainly recognize that. And again, you know, we agree that the department needs to reduce, and we're working to reduce the number of people who are in a restricted housing unit, but specifically with an emphasis on those that have a mental health illness.
And that's Shirley Moore-Smeal, Executive Deputy Secretary for the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections. Also with us, Jules LaBelle, Professor at the University of Pittsburgh Law School and President of the Center for Constitutional Rights. And we are debating, discussing solitary confinement and taking phone calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Questions or comments, do give us a call. Jules LaBelle, I know you're involved in this Pelican Bay class action lawsuit, and you mentioned the problem of gangs in that particular supermax prison. How is solitary used there? Or I guess it is. I mean, that is what it is, right? It's a solitary confinement prison.
It's a solitary confinement prison. If I can paint the picture, it's a prison where people are in 80 square foot cells. with no windows. They can yell. They can talk by yelling to other people in another adjoining cell, which I assume is the same situation in Pennsylvania. The prison is there is no real meaningful social interaction between a guard who comes by and says how you're doing and a prisoner. Prisoners can talk, however, to somebody in the adjoining cell, but they never can see them, and they have to talk by shouting. That is not normal human conversation. They have no windows. They stay 23 hours a day in the cell. They then go out to another exercise cell, which is a little bigger, but until there was a hunger strike there, had nothing in it, and they exercise alone. They get no phone calls whatsoever. The prison is located 14 hours from Los Angeles. It's in one of the most remote spots in the country on the Oregon-California border, and it was deliberately designed to be isolated to make so people get very few social or family visits. And the reason that people are put in there is not, as Shirley suggests, because they are people who have murdered or assaulted other prisoners, but simply because they may have a tattoo or they may have artwork of an Aztec warrior with a spear pointed in a certain way, which the California prison officials say means that they're a member or an associated in some way with a gang. Or in many cases, particularly with the African Americans there, it's because they've written pamphlets which express a black nationalist ideology, which the prison objects to. In fact, in Pelican Bay, Swahili is a banned language. If you have a book in Swahili, you can get put or retained in solitary. So in many cases, it's used in California, and my hunch is in Pennsylvania also, as a political tool to put people who are seen as politically disruptive or politically not at odds with the prison administration into a setting that is more repressive. So you have people who have very, very little disciplinary record or very little disciplinary misconduct being put into this prison for years. And they say, 500 people for over a decade, and there is essentially no way out for many of them. That's why we're challenging this.
Right, and that's Pelican Bay in California. To you, Shirley Mortz-Meal, Jules LaBelle says, you know, what's happening in Pelican Bay probably is happening in Pennsylvania, is it?
Well, and
that you could be put in solitary because you have gang insignia or you've written some kind of political diatribe.
The reasons I stated earlier and my reflection is on the policies that are in place in Pennsylvania, not in Pelican Bay or in California. And there are very specific criteria that you have to meet in order to be placed in there. And it has to do with disruption for the security of the facility, for safety of staff, of inmates, the assaults that occur. So it's weighted based on, you really have to put forth effort to get into the restricted release list. We don't believe that it's an arbitrary process, nor a political process, but one that has public safety in mind and one that has safety of the facility in mind.
A quick question. Are they allowed television, radio, any kind of internet access within those cells?
If you're on administrative custody status, to include those that are on the restricted release list, you do have the ability to have televisions, radio, and commissary. It depends on how your adjustment is within your designated assignment.
And that's Shirley Mortz-Meal and Jules LaBelle, our guests today on Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Jules, you wanted to say something? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I just have one final comment. What Shirley just said is contradicted by the case again of Russell Schultz. She cannot explain why a man has spent over 20 years in solitary for something that he did 22 years ago, namely tried to escape, with no significant disciplinary misconduct subsequently. Now, I haven't investigated the cases of all, the dozens of people on this restricted list, but I do know very well the case of this one person, and there's no explanation except for they don't like his political views, or they just continue to keep him in solitary without a reasonable security reason. So I'd like her to explain that. She said, well, we're changing. But why has he been in solitary for 20 years?
And we have changed that process for restricted release list. And, you know, there are updates to that case in particular that are available. Basically, previously, the decision, the facility had to support, and the individual had to gain support at a facility level to say whether or not it got moved on for approval at the central office level. And so a lot of the things were stopped there at the facility. That's the part of the process that has changed. That now comes up for review through the regional, through the executive, through the secretary. And it's a matter of gaining the support from the facility level staff. At least that's the way that it was. It's no longer that case. To look specifically and to say why he in particular was denied for the years, I would need to go back and look at what the rationale was on each individual vote sheet. But now policy again has been changed that you're not going to go for an extended period of time without being reviewed. The reviews are done annually. And that annual review, whether it's a recommendation to continue on the restricted release list or to be removed on the restricted release list, now requires a higher level of review. Number one, it requires a review annually, and the review that's done is a higher level.
Well, and we're almost out of time here. Jules LaBelle, you just have 20 seconds. So go ahead.
Russell Schultz was reviewed annually every year, and every year they said the exact same thing, namely you're a threat to security, and you've been for the last 20 years. So prison officials often tell me that they're changing, but the proof is in the pudding. Russell Schultz is still in solitary. When he gets out, maybe there'll be a change.
And I would say to that Russell Schultz is now at a different facility with the goal of establishing the plan of action to get him into general population. So we've said that we've changed, and we're working diligently to make sure that our policies and our practice match and that we're doing what's in the best interest of the individual, to include the inmate, but also the best interest of the staff and the inmate population to provide for their safety.
We have to end our conversation. Shirley Moore-Smeal, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times. Jules LaBelle, thank you very much as well. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscone. Thank you for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, but stay with us. We'll be right back.